Let me begin this morning by reading with you the second chapter of 1 Timothy from verse 8 to the close of the chapter. I desire, therefore, that the men pray in every place, lifting up holy hands without wrath and disputing. In like manner that women adorn themselves in modest apparel, with shamefastness and sobriety. Not with braided hair and gold or pearls or costly raiment, but which becomes women professing godliness through good works. Let a woman learn in quietness with all subjection, but I permit not a woman to teach nor to have dominion over a man, but to be in quietness. For Adam was first formed, then Eve, and Adam was not beguiled, but the woman being beguiled hath fallen into transgression. But she shall be saved through her childbearing, if they continue in faith and love and sanctification with sobriety. Today is, by a national custom, the day that is set aside to honor mothers and motherhood. And it seems to me that that custom puts into stark relief what has happened to our society when we think about motherhood as an expression of piety, as an expression of purity, as an expression of self-sacrifice, as an expression of wisdom and goodness. To celebrate those qualities in a land that has increased its illegitimate births four times in 30 years, and where abortions run at the rate of 1.5 million every year, contains not a small irony. But if it serves to jolt us into sobriety and to realize that we have lost something very precious, and that as Christians, it is imperative that we focus very carefully on the kind of model that godly motherhood should bring to us. That doesn't happen to be my topic today, because I had something that I wanted to talk to you about and had planned to talk to you about earlier, and I must talk to you about this morning. When I think about my own mother, and when I think about the mother of my children, and I consider the modesty, and I consider the sense of shame for what is truly not good, and the sense of godly restraint that has characterized them, I confess that I weep for what is said about motherhood in these times. We do not have that model of self-sacrifice anymore. We have that model of self-seeking. When we seek ourselves and not our children, it is a horror to think about the abuse of children that goes on in this country. And the reason for it is because the model that God has established for true motherhood has been so largely lost. The text that we read speaks first to men, then to women. Obviously, Paul is addressing Christians, as I am addressing Christians today. I must tell you that as I speak on this subject, that what I have to say is not going to revolutionize someone that's in this audience who has not already been sensitized to the great principles of the gospel. I have no idea that any great or remarkable change would take place in the heart of someone who is yet to really commit deeply and profoundly their lives to the simplicity of the gospel. It will probably annoy. I don't know why it is that to address the subject of modesty and simplicity and dress seems to put everyone ill at ease, or at least many, and always the wondering about what will be said. Why should we wonder? Why should we be surprised that any part of our lives should be touched by the fact that we have said Jesus Christ is Lord and therefore His influence ought to have its sway in any aspect of our being? It seems to me that the modern expression of immodesty has grown more grievous with the passing of the days. I can recall now still the horror of the 1960s when Mary Quant, in her ingenious way, introduced the miniskirt into the world and said blatantly and openly that the purpose of it was sexuality. The thing that was horrifying was not that women of the world picked up on it rather quickly, but that Christian women did the same. And that there was no exhortation, there was no reproof, there was no instruction, there was no appeal that gospel preachers found within their vocabulary to restrain it. Godly men were embarrassed to see the open flash of thigh that characterized the times. Even judges in the courts had to put up modesty panels for the sake, they said, of the women. Reader's Digest, June 1967. Quote, "What is the point of fashion and where is it leading?" "Sex," replied Miss Quant promptly. But we've come past that to new decades and to new times, and I had a copy of a recent April issue of the Courier Journal, which anticipated the fashions of this particular year, especially in view of the coming social event of the Kentucky Derby. And several observations were made that I want to share with you from that article. Among the hottest looks here is the bear look. But you needn't put your significant other on a leash. Can you imagine something like that being written? You needn't put your significant other on a leash. It's much more subdued in Louisville than in Paris. How is it showing up here? Kathy Crum of Bacon says the bear look is very, very strong. Halter tops, backless, lattice crisscrossed backs, bustiers, tie front blouses that show the midriff. The slit pants and skirts are an important part of the bear look, and the slits can be anywhere, on dresses or pants, in front, down the side, and back. The bear look is going to be really big. Juniors will go for the little bra tops, nip halters, or blowing out all of the stores right now. I don't like to read it. That's in the public domain, the newspaper printed it. What it tells us is that what the world is doing is blatant, obvious. It's saying that what you are physically, what you can achieve in the way of physical adornment, is the most important thing about you. Do you believe that? What an expression of motherhood. To turn oneself into nothing more than a clothes horse. And not just that, not just the display of one's external person. In order to achieve attention to that. But there is the illicit and sensual display that contradicts the very idea of wisdom and restraint and concern for others and depth of character and the kinds of dispositions and attitudes that are characteristic of the gospel. You know, there's a manner of life that fits the gospel. How many times do we read it in the scripture? Ephesians chapter 4, verse 1, where Paul appeals to the Ephesians to walk worthily of the calling wherewith they were called. Philippians chapter 1 and verse 27, only let your manner of life be worthy of the gospel of Christ. 1 Thessalonians chapter 2 and verse 12, walk worthily of God who called you into His own kingdom and glory. Principle? We must live in a way that's consistent with what's happened to us, with what God has done, with what Christ has done, so that as we live, as we speak, and as we think, We're continually asking ourselves the question, how does this fit into the life of a Christian? How does this suit the kinds of principles that I learned from Jesus on the cross, in his life, and from God as a consequence of this great revelation of love and righteousness and holiness? That's the question. And then there's the appeal of Romans chapter 12, where he says that he beseeches by the mercies of God that you present your bodies as living sacrifices, holy, acceptable to God, which is your spiritual service. Be not conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. The emphasis of the spiritual life is on what happens between our ears. The kind of values we treasure, the purposes we have, the directions in which we go, what's more important to us than anything else. And the question that's usually raised when we talk about these internal spiritual qualities is, then what do clothes have to do with something so inner and so spiritual? Well, perhaps you should ask yourself that question. Everyone in this society believes that clothes are a statement. If that were not the case, you wouldn't have this large section in the Courier Journal talking about clothes. People wouldn't be concerned about clothes. It would just simply be some neutral item that served a very practical purpose. No one would imagine that there was a different statement being made by one person or another. It would just be an inconsideration. But it's not an inconsideration. Clothing has always been some kind of statement of what's in our minds, what's in our hearts. 12th chapter, Matthew, you remember Jesus in verse 33 and following, talking about the good tree and the bad tree. It said a good tree brings forth good fruit, and a bad tree brings forth bad fruit. And then he speaks about the fact that out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. We can't say mere words. These words come from within the man. And we can't say these are just clothes. They make no statement. They do make a statement. And as I've said in earlier lessons, your heart is showing in your clothing as much as in your words and other deeds. And so if the tree is good, the fruit will be good. It is no use to appeal to passages like Titus chapter 1 and verse 15 that says, to the pure all things are pure, but to the defiled and impure all things become defiled. Because that passage is not saying that somehow or another a person can be pure within and it doesn't make any difference what shows on the outside. That's just something wholly apart from what I'm thinking. I'm pure on the inside. Therefore, whatever I do must consequently be pure. Jesus didn't approach it that way. He said the fruit shows the true tree. And so the things on the outside reflect what are on the inside. And we'll never escape that. Our deeds and our words come out of the fountain of our hearts. And as certainly as Jesus says in Matthew 15:9, that out of the heart come forth fornication and adulteries and all kinds of wicked things, so also out of the heart come the good things. So we have to wrestle with this question, however sometimes sensitive, however difficult it may be. The way we dress is a profession either of godliness or is a profession of worldliness. And so Paul's exhortation in 1 Timothy chapter 2. There would have been no need for this if there were no concern about it. Does God care whether we dress or not? Are all externals of no consequence to him? Does 1 Samuel chapter 16, which says God does not see as man sees, in his response to Samuel's choice of the wrong man to be king over Israel, he said God does not see as man sees. Man looks on the outward appearance, but God looks on the heart. That's absolutely true. Does that mean that God doesn't care about the external? That's not manifest from the beginning. You read the book of Genesis and learn that the early couple in their innocence were naked. But that was in their innocence, when they knew nothing of sin, had no personal experience of it. But as soon as they had sinned, the scripture says they knew they were naked and they attempted to cover themselves. And God affirmed the rightness of that because he made for them clothing of skins. So we can rest assured that nudity is not something that God approves. Public nudity is not something that God approves. It is not a part of the program. But I want to ask you something else. Do you think he's concerned about how much of the body might be covered in order for propriety to be demonstrated? I want to share with you a passage that may slip by us sometimes in the 20th chapter of Exodus. This is the chapter in one of the two chapters in the books of the law that contain the Ten Commandments. And among the things that God said to Moses, you will find this in verses 25 and 26. And if you make me an altar of stone, you shall not build it of hewn stones, for if you will lift up your tool upon it, you have polluted it. Neither shall you go up by steps to mine altar, that your nakedness be not uncovered thereon. God was concerned about that. You and I ought to be concerned about it. There's another text that speaks to that same particular matter about the dress of the priests. Chapter 28 of Exodus, which says that there are to be pants that are to be worn by the priests so that they will cover from the waist through the thighs. That indicates a concern, and that concern was first expressed about men. All through the Old Testament, the idea of nakedness is associated with shame. The shame of your nakedness. That was verses 42 and 43, by the way, in chapter 28. Isaiah 47:3 speaks of the judgment of God upon Babylon, and God says there by Isaiah, your nakedness shall be uncovered. Yes, your shame shall be seen. In Jeremiah 13, in verse 26, of the judgment of Judah, therefore will I also uncover your skirts upon your face, and your shame shall appear. There is a shame in nakedness. We all sense this. I'm not telling you anything. But that sense of shame can be lost as a consequence of the practices, attitudes, and dispositions of people. Something happens inside your heart. Another indication of nakedness, another meaning to nakedness, is given in the 8th chapter of Luke in the case of the man who was mad, who was possessed by many demons, Luke 8:27. It says that he never wore any clothes, lived among the tombs. And when you see someone, I once saw a woman walking down the street naked in Ibadan, Nigeria, and I knew she was mad. She was mad as a hatter. No one would have ever done that in Nigeria unless they had been totally insane. But people do it in this society who's supposed to be very sane. But that's not the will of God. And it's an expression of shamefulness, public nudity, which is common in our society, is a reproach to the Spirit of Christ and indicates either total innocence, which we doubt, derangement, or depravity. Now, if God is concerned about our having clothed ourselves, and if God is concerned about the extent of that clothing, we have to ask ourselves, how are we to be guided in determining how we ought to dress? Well, the first great principle is that it ought to be consistent with and befitting the gospel of Christ and all the principles that are part of that. And someone says, well, that means it's a matter of judgment, doesn't it? Well, yes. But that doesn't mean that you can do anything you want or wear anything you want. That doesn't mean that all judgments are equally valid, or that you are turned loose, or that I am turned loose to just express myself in any way I want, any way I feel. so far as my dress, my clothing is concerned. There are principles here. And the fundamental one is, does it reflect the kind of truth that we see in the gospel? Does it reflect a concern for others? Does it reflect a concern for righteousness? Does it reflect a concern for purity and for holiness? Does it make a statement of that? It's always been interesting to me when some young men get involved in some serious criminal activity and they've got hair hanging clear down their back and maybe in these days wearing two or three earrings and wearing the scruffiest old clothes you could imagine, that as soon as they're brought into court by their attorneys, you never saw such a cleanup job. What do they wear? You know, what these attorneys know in their worldly wisdom, is that clothes make a statement. And they'll have an impression on the jury. So those young men will look as they have never looked in their lives. They'll have on maybe a double-breasted suit, a nice tie, and a nice shirt. Hair will be cut. You know, the children of this world are wiser than the sons of the kingdom sometimes about such matters. So we need to be governed by great principles, not conform to this world. Sometimes we decide what we're going to wear on the basis of, well, it's a little better than the average. I'm doing better than the world. Well, is that the standard you're to use? Are we to say we're doing better than what people of the world are doing? Or are we not to be conformed to the world? Isn't that the principle? We're not to use them as a standard. And if we are to use them as a standard, we need to look and see what's moving them. Sensuality? Blatant sexuality? Young ladies, these slits in clothing are intended to be sexually alluring. The effect is one of letting you see what you shouldn't have seen and then not letting you see it. There's no mystery here. That's the purpose. And if that's what you want to wear, to give alluring views every now and then of parts of your body that ought not to be seen at all in public, then what you're doing, and I'm saying this to you realizing that you may not even be aware of it, may not have thought about it, but your parents can tell you. We had a sister in Christ in Joplin, Missouri, who, after hearing a discussion of modest dress, was surprised that anyone would ever raise questions about a woman wearing a pair of shorts. She didn't think there was anything wrong with it. And so she went to her husband and asked him if it were true that men were stirred by that sort of appearance. He said, yes. She said, why did you never tell me? And I was astonished myself that a woman who had been married for a number of years was that naive. It's the world we live in. And it's not something that was just created yesterday. Men are attracted by that sort of thing. And the purpose of dress that has that quality about it is to attract a man's sensual attention. It is not befitting a woman who is godly. It does not make a statement of godliness. It does not make a statement of purity. And I want to add something else. In this same article that came from the Courier Journal, which said all these wonderful things about the bear look, and talking about Paris, said flesh, not a flash of flesh, but wholesale flesh. That's what Paris was doing. They didn't think it was going to come to Louisville. And I certainly hope not, and especially not the car wash skirt, which is made out of parallel strips of fabric that look like the plastic strips in a car wash. And, you know, they move about and give you views that will scintillate and attract. But this is a statement that was made. Bacon's crumb also heralds the long look. Quote, "We're talking long. This is floor length and ankle length," unquote. And then the writer of the article says, "And with the long look, hemline length is no longer as important. Rhodes Clayton emphatically states there is no hemline length. Hemline length is no longer an issue. It's more of personal choice." So if you choose to wear these brief skirts, it will not be because you've been forced to it by style. I particularly noticed on some of our young ladies here, some very brief skirts, well above the knee. And I have asked myself, with love in my heart and with concern, where are the fathers of these young ladies and the mothers of these young ladies to tell them what that says? In a land where fornication is rife, illegitimate births among teenagers have doubled since 1972, going out the roof. And we seem disposed to want thoughtlessly to play to that. The Apostle Paul in our text says that the godly woman should wear modest apparel. I'm not under the impression that that principle would apply only to women. I'm sure from verse 8, God would want women to lift up holy hands without wrath and dispute. But the particular challenge of men is addressed there. And then a particular challenge of women. But I don't suppose for a single moment that these principles don't need to be applied to young men and to those that are not young anymore, as much as to women. Modest apparel. Orderly, well-arranged, and decent. Decent in what sense? In the sense of what God has said and the truth of the gospel. Appropriate, seemly, suitable. Now, it doesn't make one whit of difference what you wear if you're not a Christian. You've made no commitment. I don't mean by that that God's unconcerned, but I mean it'd be difficult for you to be seemly and appropriate in your dress when you've made no statement of commitment to Christ. But to those of us who've made a statement of commitment to Christ, we need to have appropriate dress. Now, that means dress that's not ostentatious, not the putting on of apparel, gold and silver and pearls and all those things. We're not talking about the sin of gold, or the sin of pearls, or the sin of particular hairstyles. We're talking about this ornateness of dress that calls attention to that which is physical. And the second principle is with shamefastness, or a sense of shame, a sense of propriety that prevents any moral acts, says Vine. Trench, an innate moral repugnance to the doing of the dishonorable act. A Christian woman wears her clothes so as to suggest that the doing of a dishonorable deed would be repulsive to her. That's the kind of statement you want to make to everybody around you. That you'd have nothing to do with something cheap. That you're not available for any kind of sexual assignation, that you're not trying to attract it, that you do not want it. And it's absolutely appalling to me to think that parents of young ladies would want to stand by and watch this daughter begin to wear things that making that kind of statement. And I hold especially fathers responsible. Because they know. And the leadership that should be offered at this particular juncture is just not being offered. I don't know what are the reasons. I know that young people have a special pressure from their peers. And as much as I appeal to them to live as they ought to live because they have made a promise to God that they're going to do that if they're Christians, I understand that sometimes they have those pressures on them to conform, that
that this is not a conspiracy to be attractive to the physical sexuality of their being, and to draw that to themselves. I understand that, but I do not understand. I do not understand how mature parents can fail to direct these young people. They need your insight. You're going to have to exercise some control and some restraint in their lives because they are not yet sensitive to some of these things, but it's our task to teach them, not the foul or the filthy, but the pure and the high and the holy that just excludes all this, takes it out, keeps it away from us. A sense of shame. What's shameful? That has to be taught. It's not innate. You don't grow up with it. It is a product of godliness. It is a product of the love of God. It is a product of the love of others. And finally, he says, with sobriety, soundness of mind, comes from a Greek term that means to recall one to his senses. And it just says that you need to live your life, not just about clothes, but about everything, with good sense, knowing what it can do. And the good sense you need to have here is that if you display your body in these sensual ways, you're going to attract to yourself sensually disposed people. Is that what you want? Is that all there is to you? There's no depth of character. Proverbs 11:22 will soon become applicable to you if you pursue that. As a gold ring and a pig's snout, so is a fair woman who has no discretion. Purity in the heart results in purity of deed and is reflected in all that we do. Modesty, shamefastness, and sobriety. But somebody says, it's still a matter of judgment. I know that. But shall we exercise the judgment of the worldly or the judgment of the spiritual? Philippians chapter 1. Paul urges his faithful brethren at Philippi. Verse 10 and 11. So that you may... Well, let's start with 9. And this I pray, that your love may abound yet more and more in knowledge and all discernment, so that you may approve the things that are excellent, that you may be sincere and void of offense unto the day of Christ, being filled with the fruits of righteousness which are through Jesus Christ to the glory and praise of God. He said, I want you to develop a sense, a keen sense of spiritual discernment and wisdom. Now, some of us are not in any position to make a decision about what we're going to wear or anything else for that matter, because we have not developed a keen spiritual sensitivity. Hebrews chapter 5 speaks about that. Beginning with verse 11, of whom we have many things to say, and hard of interpretation, seeing you become dull of hearing. For when by reason of the time you ought to be teachers, you have need again that someone teach you the rudiments of the first principles of the oracles of God, and are become such as have need of milk and not of solid food. For every one that partakes of milk is without experience of the word of righteousness, for he is a babe. But solid food is for full-grown men, even those who by reason of use have their senses exercised to discern good and evil. Principles are here. Principles of godliness, principles of purity that ought to lead us and guide us, not what's happening in the world. The first question we ask should not be, is this stylish? Will I be seen as being up to date if I wear this? Will this appeal to my worldly friends if I wear this? But is this right before God? Let me tell you something. It won't be too long until all these clothes are not going to matter a hill of beans. They're going to be rags somewhere. And your life is going to progress if the good thing happens to you. Your life is going to progress along a course that will make all those considerations infinitesimally small and being good and right and pure and loving and pleasing to God is going to be the thing that drives your life. Don't make a mistake now. Don't make decisions now that are just simply not based upon a good sensitivity to what is right and wrong. I said already that if your heart is not committed, then this will be a burdensome thing to you. This will be a meddlesome sermon that gets into areas that nobody knows anything about. Well, if nobody knows anything about that or can know anything about it, why does the Bible talk about it? Why do we have instruction here? And I would think that those who love the Lord would want to be on the safe side of everything. That's just the spirit of a person who's trying to serve God and would not want to do anything wrong, trying to stay as far away from it as possible. But my impression is, and I'll leave you with this, that we are having increasing insensitivity to modesty among both men and women in the kingdom of God. And sometimes it's not just immodesty as a result of going to the beach with the brief attire that's involved. And by the way, if you're doing that, I know nothing I've said here is going to make any difference what you wear. You can wear it right up to the crotch, I guess, out in public. Indecent. Not modest. Not something that accords with the principles we've read here. You say, but no one thinks anything about in the world. In this world, no one thinks much about anything. It's an ungodly generation. You're not to be governed by that. You don't want to be governed by that. You want to be something different than that. And I hope you've thought about it. I hope this summer, if you got out in that kind of attire, that your mind will be sensitized to what you're doing. And I hope you'll realize that even if your own thoughts are where they ought to be, you're enticing somebody else. And don't make any mistake about that. And I want to make an appeal to parents. You know, we get awfully nervous about this and we get sensitive about it. But I just have one question. What are you teaching your children? Let's say it is a matter of judgment. What principles are you teaching your children? What guidelines are you giving them to help them know what is modest and what is not? Is it just a rule of thumb? Or are there some true principles involved here? If you're just letting happen what will happen, I can tell you. What's going to happen is there's not going to be any modesty. And the consequence of that can be most unhappy. Not just hereafter, which is the ultimate concern, but even in the present. We need, in every church of the Lord, parents who teach their children earnest modesty and godliness in dress. And we need teachers in those churches who will address this subject. My experience is that the subject goes unaddressed. And there's only one direction that things are going to go when that happens. And we need elders and deacons who will address these subjects in the classes and personally and privately as they talk to other Christians about the subject. And we need earnest, godly women who will help to teach and instruct in this way and add their part to it. If you ask me if I have all the answers, I will tell you I do not. But I believe they're to be had. And I don't believe that the pattern of our dress reflects what I see in the Scripture. And then I'll give you one addendum, and then I'm going to leave the subject for this time. I don't promise that I won't come back to it. There's not only the matter of dress that is not sensual, but there's a matter of dress that is appropriate. And this assembly has a certain quality about it, this public assembly of Christians. And we'll be back again this evening and back on Wednesday night. Remember that what you wear makes a statement about how you feel about what's happening. It's not a matter of display. It's not a matter of pretension. It's a matter of dressing in a way that's honorable. If what we wear is inconsequential to the occasion, then it's strange to me that people seem to dress certain ways on certain occasions and would feel horrified were they found dressed in a different way. If they were called to some significant meeting and found in their work clothes, they would be mortified to be present with those people in that state. I want to urge upon you that you think, men and women, about what you wear at these assemblies. These tight spandex pants are likely something that ought not to be worn anywhere in public, but they have no place here. And these new short suits, we've got shorts now that are taking on the formal attire characterization. They don't have a place here either. We need to come here dressed in a sober way. I could preach in my jeans. I work in the garden often in them. Sometimes I work in my tie too, but I could preach in my jeans. You wouldn't like it too well. Wearing my old shirts up here, you wouldn't care for it. You'd think I was scandalizing the church. Well, it's not just me, you know. It's all of us that think about that. I know you'll think about it. Had no doubt about it when I spoke to this particular issue, and that you'll pray about it, and that was my intention. That we think about our hearts and then let our hearts be reflected in the way we live, the way we speak, the way we dress, so that those who look at us will give thanks for the influence of God in our lives. We are more than clothes, of course. But the clothes reflect what we are inside. Thank you for listening. Appreciate your being here. We're delighted with those who come to visit, share this time of worship with us. But because we are Christians and because it is our passion to teach Christ to others, and we want men to be saved, and we want no one to go to hell. Our Father wants no one to go to hell. And so we appeal, and we appeal, and we appeal for people to come and confess Jesus and trust in Him and do His will, be baptized into Him, and to live their lives for Him. And so that's exactly what we're doing when we stand to sing this hymn. We're appealing for you to come. And if you want to be a Christian and live your life in purity and holiness, forgiven and cleansed of all the past, then you just come and take your seat here at the front, and we'll help you to be a child of God while we're standing together and singing.